You know, maybe what America needs right now is a Secretary of Agriculture with some practical skills for a change.
Put water in this thing right here, these two barrels. Put your fire down there. Get your water hot, get your water to boiling. Your steam would come out of this pipe here.
A lot of farmers know how to make moonshine, only today they call it ethanol, and producing it on a large scale is a big part of Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack's agenda. As Secretary of Agriculture, the ethanol issue becomes a Vilsack debate. 21st Century Moonshine on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 18th, and I learned something this morning. I had no idea that ethanol and moonshine had anything in common. So thank you for that.
Just careful as you sip some of that. It's really strong. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning. Today, we're going to take a look at the Agriculture Department under an Obama administration. Also, a new angle on the markets and thoughts on Zimbabwe from the U.S. ambassador. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
Well, take all the time you need for the holidays. In fact, take a little extra. That's the message from Chrysler to its employees. Spokesman Ed Garston says Chrysler is closing all 30 of its manufacturing plants for a month.
After the last shift this Friday, manufacturing operations will be idled. And employees at those plants won't return to work any sooner than Monday, January 19th.
Ford also said it would shut down 10 of its plants for an extra week, and the Wall Street Journal is reporting that GM has restarted merger talks with Chrysler.
The Securities and Exchange Commission is investigating possible conflicts of interest that may have prevented the agency from following up on repeated warnings about Bernie Madoff's alleged $50 billion pyramid scheme. Madoff's niece is married to a former SEC lawyer who examined Madoff's firm twice in the past decade. The agency denies any improprieties. A former member of the SEC will inherit this investigation. President-elect Barack Obama is expected to announce Mary Shapiro as the next SEC head. According to Democratic officials, should be the first woman to head the commission.
The two Republicans, is it enough for Obama's cabinet? There are two Republican cabinet members. Illinois Congressman Ray LaHood is expected to be named Secretary of Transportation. You know the other one?
Yes, I do. Robert Gates,
Defense Secretary. Illinois Supreme Court has refused to hear a challenge to oust Governor Rod Blagojevich from office. Attorney General Lisa Madigan has argued the governor's legal problems are keeping him from performing his duties, but Blagojevich's attorney disagrees.
Someone alleged that they had my client's voice on tape. And the fact of the matter is that's not evidence. The fact of the matter is it's not evidence to pick and choose and cherry-pick people who are just talking.
Blagojevich has been charged with trying to sell Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat. New unemployment numbers are due out this hour, and the Conference Board will release its last month's index of leading economic indicators later this morning. It's expected to show the recession continuing for several more months. Dow futures are currently up slightly, but the market will probably open flat. So, hey, the English are using ABBA to pull themselves out of their economic depression. But can you do better than Dancing Queen?
This is Chris calling from Dartmouth, and when I need to cheer myself up, I don't sing any songs. I recount lines from the Seinfeld show. La, la, la. Hello!
Love our listeners, man.
Yeah, that's a good one.
What's your escape? What cheers you up? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We just want to remind you, the British, the highest grossing movie in the UK is Mamma Mia. Okay, what does that say about the British in these recessionary times? We want your cheer up suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And we're going to begin with kind of a farm report this morning. We're not going to tell you how to make moonshine, much as we would like to help you with that. But the Agriculture Department is certainly responsible for programs that encourage farmers to produce ethanol from corn, ethanol, moonshine, biofuel. fuels. It's just one of the issues facing former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, who could be the next Secretary of the Department of Agriculture. And we want to remind you all that it's a vast federal agency, the Department of Agriculture, responsible for everything from food stamps to forestry. Joining us to talk about it is Ben Shute, who is owner and manager of Hearty Roots Community Farm in Tivoli, New York. Ben, thanks for joining the show.
Good morning.
And from Washington, D.C., Sandra Schubert joins us. She's a director of government affairs at the Environmental Working Group in Washington. Sandra, thanks for being part of the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Let me begin with you, Ms. Schubert. Is the Vilsack nomination something that represents a kind of new vision for the Department of Agriculture, or is this more of a management decision in your view?
Well, we're very encouraged by the nomination. Governor Vilsack has made some positive statements about farm subsidy reform, getting rid of subsidies for corn ethanol, and moving forward on some positive renewable energy projects on agricultural land, such as wind energy. So we're encouraged by it.
And what about the ethanol sort of issue? Tom Vilsack has been a real advocate of ethanol production. Of course, the state of Iowa does a really good job at producing ethanol. Nevertheless, during the sort of food price spikes of earlier this year, the competition with ethanol production for corn proved to be a destabilizing part of the market. What's your view there?
Well, Mr. Vilsack's clearly going to be very positive on biofuels, but I would like to point out that when he was in charge of one of the committees for the Council of Foreign Relations, they recommended phasing out subsidies for corn-based ethanol and other mature biofuels. So we're hopeful that he'll take some of these steps when he's at USDA.
Ben Shute, what's your view of Tom Vilsack? And I suspect that as part of a community farm, buying local is a pretty important issue to you.
Certainly. To me, I think one of the most exciting and hopeful things going on in agriculture today are the small and medium-sized farms that are doing more organic farming and regional marketing. And from that perspective, I am a little worried about the appointment of Tom Vilsack. I know that a lot of his experience with farm issues is on the side of the larger agribusiness. He has some close ties with the Monsanto Corporation and with a lot of genetically engineered farm-related issues. And so I'm a little more nervous about what's to come with.
Well, let's get into that a little bit. What makes you nervous? What specific policies do you expect Vilsack will back, and at the expense of what in your world?
Well, I'm hopeful that he will give a lot of attention to what I see as a more progressive farming movement, because it really does hold out a lot of hope for me. The way I see things going, these small family farms are really revitalizing rural communities, are putting the health of people at the forefront, you know, using natural practices, taking care of the soil, taking care of the ecosystems. And I just don't see that Tom Vilsack has spent a lot of attention on that, has gotten to know those farmers, has a real strong vision for how that can be pushed forward and really provide a model for how farming can be in the future.
I'm just wondering, since Congress already has set aside crop subsidies and other agricultural policies for the next 5 years after the Farm Bill was adopted in May, how much power is Vilsack really going to have as Cabinet Secretary? Sandra?
Well, Governor Vilsack can have an effect in a couple ways. President-elect Obama has already indicated that he has significant concerns with multimillionaires getting taxpayer subsidies through the Farm Bill. They can follow through to address some of those issues in the budget process. There is also going to be a long process of Farm Bill implementation. As my colleague on the phone points out, there are a lot of good conservation and environmental programs that need to be put in place and strengthened to ensure that both our soil, our water, and our air quality and our farms are strong into the future.
But, Sandra, what do you think about Ben's notion that Tom Vilsack doesn't have much of a reputation in supporting small family farms, local agriculture?
Well, Iowa tends to have a lot of large farms, but Mr. Vilsack has been, he's been in this area for a long time. We do think that we agree that we need to focus our attention, our monies, into helping the truly smaller, struggling farmers, that we need to stop giving these large plantation-scale farm subsidies. He has made some encouraging statements along those lines. I do think we'll see how he is able to implement some of these statements over the next few or so years. And we hope that he will look into the 21st century and develop a farm policy that's forward-looking and not keep in place the same outdated policies that we saw pass in the last farm bill.
Sandra, though, is it possible that that's just a lot of hope, that the economy right now, with its demand for jobs and demand for products to export and the need to really pull ourselves off of foreign-based fossil fuels is going to really chuck a lot of this kind of folksy, lovable, local farm agenda right off of the front burner?
Well, it shouldn't. What we see in farm subsidies is 10% of farmers get two-thirds of the money. Those tend to be the large-scale farmers. Also, in the arena of biofuels, were we to plant our entire agricultural land in corn for ethanol, we would only supplant 15% of our gasoline. We cannot plant our way out of our oil and gas problems. And yes, there's a lot of hope in this nomination. We have not seen a lot of progress on farm policy in the last farm bill. We were disappointed in the way that happened. But Mr. Vilsack and President-elect Obama have a historic opportunity right now to change the path that these programs are taken and focus them on what is really good not only for oil and gas, but farmers, family farmers, smaller farmers that are struggling but tend not to get the support of government that these large farms get.
Ben, just to follow up on that thought, what are you most worried about that the next agriculture secretary won't do?
I still am hopeful that he does have the opportunity, and I see it as a huge opportunity for Obama and Vilsack to, at this point now, appoint undersecretaries and other key staff people in the Department of Agriculture who really are champions of this movement towards a more ecological and reasonably sized agricultural base. And so I really hope that they will see that as an opportunity, because I think we're at a turning point where we can either go forward with more of the same policies that have pushed out medium-sized and small family farmers and consolidated the power into larger, less sustainable corporate agriculture entities. I really am hopeful that we will see a lot of attention put towards that. I'm just concerned that it may not be the first priority. And I know that as part of the Obama platform, he does cite encouraging young farmers, encouraging small farmers, and encouraging organic farming practices. So I'm really hoping to see some more appointments along those lines.
Hoping, encourage. Look, there's a public health disaster in the United States on obesity that many have linked to high fructose corn syrup and other corn-based sweeteners. I mean, it seems to me that there ought to be a good, passionate case for using the subsidy model to get it away from big agribusiness and more towards organic farms, to bring the price of organic produce down, to channel people into eating foods that are more healthy. Ben, I'm surprised you're not sort of railing a little more passionately about this.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, currently, while big commodity corn producers see huge subsidies every year, a farm like mine, which grows organic vegetables for local and regional distribution, sees absolutely no encouragement from the government whatsoever, not a dime. Now, I'm not asking for subsidies, but I am asking for our policies to be more aligned with the health of our communities, the health of our citizens, and the health of our land.
Sandra, would you go along with that?
We couldn't agree more with all those points. It is time that
all right,
we
but
stopped.
The too much agreement, we're going to put everyone to sleep here. Okay, so let's just change the subject. Listen to the farm report already this morning?
just what you've told me so far.
I see. So the farm report is a thing of the past. Are you harvesting anything for the holiday meal?
We've got most of our crops in already. Our root crops in the cellar, and still pulling some hardy greens out of our fields and out of our greenhouse. And that's the great thing about a farm like ours is we're providing value to our community year round. We can really push our season. We're not just running out there on our combine once a year and harvesting a whole bunch of commodities. We're providing value to our community all the time.
Ben Shute, owner and manager of Hearty Roots Community Farm. And I didn't even get a chance to ask Sandra Schubert if she has a garden. She's director of government affairs at the Environmental Working Group in Washington, D.C. Thanks to you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So is it feel-good musical desperation that Mamma Mia is the top-grossing film in the UK ever? Or is it some sort of deeper anthropology? We'll explore that in a moment. But what musical or movie do you listen to in these recessionary days?
Hi, David Cherson here from Belmont, Mass. Please, no ABBA. I worked for a Swedish company once, and I had ABBA up the you-know-what. There's nothing like good old Chicago blues. And you may think it doesn't lift you, but it lifts me. Anything Elmore James, the sky is crying.
The sky's crying.
Oh, baby, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
That's such a great mix of music. We're going to turn to Illinois, where so far the embattled governor there has been able to hold on to his seat. The state Supreme Court refused to strip Rod Blagojevich of the power to appoint someone to Barack Obama's soon-to-be vacant Senate seat. Now, as Illinois lawmakers grapple with what to do with that Senate seat and the corruption charges surrounding the governor, legendary Chicago defense attorney Ed Jensen has begun the governor's defense.
The media is taking control. And I think the case is not what it seems, and I think that when it comes to pass, you'll see it's not what it seems, and you'll find that he's not guilty.
In just 3 days, Jensen has challenged the evidence, he's blamed the media, he's asked the Illinois Attorney General to recuse herself, and he's announced that the governor has no intentions of appointing anyone to that Senate seat, all at $700 an hour. He's made his reputation representing high-profile clients, some with connections to the mob. Chicago journalist Steve Rhodes has been covering him for years. He joins us now. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Jensen's been called a miracle worker by prosecutors. He's certainly not a shy man, but how did he earn that label?
Well, he's got a reputation as being the go-to guy if you're the person not only in trouble, but as he often describes it, a person in the emergency room or stricken with cancer who needs his life saved. And he has saved some of those lives either by winning acquittals, even in the most recent case with R. Kelly, for example.
Right.
Or
which involved videotape, we should mention, by the way.
That's right. And a case that I don't think anyone in Chicago, any reporters, at least in Chicago, watching that case, thought that R. Kelly was innocent, but Ed Jensen worked his magic there. And quite often, being the case with Ed, because of the nature of his clients, who almost always are guilty, a win for him is often not just an acquittal, but maybe a conviction, but he wins a lower sentence. Finds a lot of mitigating circumstances, gets the best deal out of the bargain without making a plea, but by going to court and getting the best possible outcome.
Well, quickly describe his style, and then let's talk about what he's done on behalf of Governor Blagojevich this week.
Sure, he's aggressive, and as you mentioned, with what he's done already in the impeachment process here, he will attack every detail, every technicality. He's very aggressive, but he's not a slick, charming, kind of phony, obsequious kind of lawyer that we often see. He's not a corporate type. He's really old school Chicago. He's often a bit disheveled. He's got kind of scraggly, curly hair in the back of his head. He's balding in front. And he's disarming in some ways because he, for a long time, he's used a cane. He has a neurological disorder that makes it painful to walk, and now he uses an electric scooter that is kind of moves excruciatingly slow as he rides into the courtroom.
I guess you should probably add an adjective there. I mean, he's pretty fearless. Let's listen to how he's even taking on Illinois lawmakers.
The fact of the matter is they made comments which shows they can't be fair. They made comments which shows that Rabovoyevich cannot get a fair and impartial hearing of this committee. And I would ask that Representative Tracy, Representative Frank, and Representative Black be precluded from participating in this hearing.
He's made no bones, and he has made it absolutely clear that he's going to challenge anything that might help his client. I mean, might hurt his client.
That's right. I mean, his style is to take the most aggressive position right from the start, and he is fearless in the sense that his clients are often public villains. They're often the public villain number one of the moment, and he goes, I think he relishes challenging the awesome power of the federal government in these cases.
Well, he called this case fun, didn't he? And isn't it a bold move to say that the governor is going to hold a news conference tomorrow?
It is. You never know what this governor is going to do. He's not. He doesn't have the most rational track record. On the other hand, he is. The governor is someone who you would describe as being slick and a charmer, and that's part of how he got elected twice. But it is, Ed Jensen is, as you said, fearless, and I think that rubs off on his clients as well.
Steve Rhodes, what a perfect line to end on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Steve Rhodes is a Chicago journalist who profiled Ed Jensen for Chicago Magazine in 2005 and has continued to cover him.
I don't know what Walter promised you, but I can tell
you. A miracle worker.
Oh, he misspoke. I'm not a miracle worker. I'm a janitor.
Couldn't get you a miracle worker. I got you George Clooney from Michael Clayton there at Dora. Headlines now from Femi. Okay.
Can you get me George Clooney?
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
I'm on it.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Time is 28 minutes past the hour. Detroit's big three are scaling back even more. Chrysler is closing all 30 of its North American manufacturing plants for at least a month, starting on Friday. GM is stopping construction of a plant involved in producing the Volt, and Ford also says it will shut down 10 plants for an extra week in January. A State Department advisory panel is recommending that Blackwater Worldwide will be dropped as the main private security contractor for American diplomats in Iraq. A decision on the panel's recommendation will be left to the Obama administration. Attorney General Michael Mukasey is reaccusing himself from the investigation into Bernie Madoff's alleged $50 billion investment fraud. The AG's son is representing a top financial officer at Madoff's investment firm. Oil prices hovered near 4.5-year lows today as a persistent investor pessimism over global crude demand outweighed OPEC's plan to make its largest ever production cut. That's a look at stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Our takeaway question this morning is a bit of psychology and anthropology altogether. What song is it that you listen to get you out of the economic recession? We've asked this question a couple times in the past, but today it's for anthropological reasons that we're asking it, because I don't know if you've heard this or not, or you understand what's going on over in the UK. The highest grossing movie of all time, edging out Titanic as of last week, is the movie Mamma Mia, which, of course, contains the music of ABBA. And what's going on in the UK? We want to know. But while you're thinking about that, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org is to call and register your musical suggestion for getting out of this recession. All right, movie, whatever you do. Escapist entertainment is kind of the focus, and they're really escaping over in the UK, listening to Mamma Mia, watching the movie. It's the film adaptation of the musical based around the songs of ABBA. It was a smash hit in London's theater, and it's a hit on Broadway here. But the movie has really spiked in a way that maybe it's a little bit disturbing, and here to talk about all things that are alarming and worrisome about the UK and British culture generally is Paddy O'Connell, or Patrick O'Connell, presenter, host of Broadcasting House on BBC Radio. Paddy, thanks for joining us.
John, Adora, thank you for the music.
Yes, well, this this is an urgent issue, and because our roots are so close to you in the UK, that something like this would happen makes us look deep into ourselves and wonder, you know, what's going on here?
Well, don't just pin it on us. 15 countries have made this movie number one. And Titanic, which goes on for like 2 days, and you know what happens at the end anyway, the boat hits the iceberg, that's been rightly beaten by a sort of song and dance number with an incomprehensible plot about a girl who invites three men, one of whom she believes to be her father, to her wedding in Greece, and it's all set to the music of ABBA.
Yeah. Okay, ABBA is invading. But does this connect with something that's going on in the UK right now? What do you think it is?
Well, for a start, we're like you. You can't move for bad news. Everywhere you go, someone says, you look ill, your job's going to go, your car's rusting. It's just so miserable that obviously people are looking for escape. That's the same all over the place. And this film has gone quickly to number one because what's happened is 30 million people saw the stage show. There are sing-along versions, and there are multiple visits. So gay men go along, gay girls go along, women fighting back against, you know, a life of gloom are going
Be
back.
Be careful there, Paddy.
But it's not a movie for Joe Sixpack, I don't think.
No, but it's interesting that you say that, because I saw the production in London many years ago, and you couldn't get tickets. It was a very sought-after play when it was on the stage.
Yes, you're right. And it's been going for about 9 or 10 years, and people came from all over the place, and they keep going back. And that's the key thing for the market men and women, that people will go back to it. But it also chimes, John, with what you said to me earlier. There are other signs that the British are turning to a sort of nostalgia feel-good at this time of year as well.
Nostalgia? Hold on a second. These are blonde people with nice teeth singing in Swedish accents. What's nostalgic about that for people in the UK?
Well, ABBA broke out from the Eurovision Song Contest in 1974, so this film is also number one in Sweden and Germany at the moment. New Zealand and South Africa have also made it number one, so it's not just the crazy British who've latched onto something that isn't just about unremitting economic disastrous gloom and horror.
You're on the edge of a cultural tsunami. You know, in our studio here, gagging away to this is Femi Oke, who actually hates the movie, and you have a UK passport, right?
I have a UK passport.
Well, give it back.
Maybe I brought my taste out of the country with me. This is an awful, awful, awful movie. I didn't pay for the ticket, and I still wanted my money back at the end of it. Now, I do love...
What's wrong with it? How can the movie be awful and the musical is great?
Because the acting is really over the top.
The acting is over the top.
The dancing is terrible.
You want cinematic realism in Mamma Mia?
But maybe this is why it's such a hit, because it's the sort of dancing that you can do, the sort of dancing that you did as a kid in front of the TV. It's that sort of dancing, really bad dance routines in the movie, I have to say, not in the production.
I think that we should add here that the movie has garnered 2 Golden Globe Awards. So there are certainly, there's somebody here in the United States, because we're talking about it was nominated for Best Film, Musical or Comedy, and Best Actress, Musical or Comedy.
All right.
Somebody likes it here in the U.S.
So, Patty, do you dance to an ABBA score in the morning in your bathrobe?
No, to be honest. I mean, I get Femi's point. I mean, this is a bit about the embarrassing uncle at the wedding. I was always told, if you can't dance, this is one simple maneuver you need to do. You need to, as a man, you need to stand up. You need to adopt a surfing position. So you lean slightly back on your left foot. You put both arms out as if you're on a surfboard, and then you drop back on your left knee whilst moving your arms in the sort of surfing position.
And all right, people, I got you. All right.
You can see that?
I can see it. Okay, ready? Go. Here we go.
Everyone, go. With the music. Now.
You guys are scaring me.
You see, people think you can dance.
Patty, that's very convincing.
It's good, isn't it? Can you see me?
Nice hip action there.
Those aren't hips.
Oops. That...
But listen, I think the point is, so many lies are told about the British. We don't have sex. We've got bad teeth. But ultimately...
And your point would be what, Paddy?
These are lies. And
yes.
What we're seeing here is you've got to put this together. This is not to everyone's taste. And Femi's right to remind us that there are people who hate ABBA, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
But listen, don't go carried away. There's a big movement at the moment to bring back the band Take That, with whom Robbie Williams was part of.
No. We'll be back to talk with you for that moment. Paddy O'Connell, he's kind of our... will we call him Richard Simmons? Maybe. Paddy O'Connell hosts a broadcasting house on BBC Radio talking about the largest, highest grossing movie of all time in the UK, Mamma Mia. Thanks, Paddy.
Thanks, John, Adora, and even you, Femi.
Thanks, Paddy.
Happy holidays.
Be careful with that dancing.
Surfing position, left knee, okay. I'll remember that for life. Femi Okay's got the headlines. Come on, Fem.
Good morning, Mamma Mia. We do have new unemployment numbers just out this morning, and they dropped more than expected to 554,000, but that's still close to last week's 26-year high. The UN says that more than 1,000 people have died from the cholera outbreak in Zimbabwe, and the number of suspected cases is 20 times that. The World Health Organization says the total number of cases could reach 60,000 unless the epidemic is stopped. Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich has one less worry as he fights to stay in office. The state's highest court refused to hear a challenge from Illinois Attorneys General about the governor's fitness to serve. Now, the governor has a feisty defense team, including Sam Adam. And Adam says the governor can't defend with just a few quotes from transcripts.
How can you ask a man to come face charges that aren't there? We don't know whether or not he can answer them. Give us the tapes.
And Governor Blagojevich is accused of trying to sell Barack Obama's vacated Senate seat. And he's still, right now, in office, still going to work. That's a look at the news.
Got a good lawyer there. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And distinguishing the signal from the noise in economic stats is our challenge this morning. New jobless claims dropped more than expected to 554,000. They remain near the 26-year high. But again, that's viewed as sort of a noise, not really a signal of the overall trend in employment, which is expected to be down. But this is a day of trading on Wall Street and other markets around the world that follows a record steep decline in the U.S. dollar against the yen. And in many ways, equities are not the signal in economic trends right now. Other things like currency and commodities maybe are. James Hickman now joins us. He's managing director of Caxton FX Foreign Exchange Brokers. He joins us from London. James, thanks for being with us.
Yes, you're welcome.
Is the trading center, the sort of economic trend center in terms of the market, more in the currency realm, especially when you see these giant moves by the dollar and the pound sterling?
Almost certainly. I think currency markets are much more of an immediate view of the economy, whereas stock markets are looking much more forward-looking. So I think analysts are pricing in for an 18 months ahead, whereas currencies certainly are looking at immediate trends.
Well, what does the dollar's drop say right now? And it's sort of curious to me that with OPEC cutting the price or cutting production and the dollar dropping so steeply, it still didn't register very much at all in the price of oil. So I kind of don't even know what's going on here.
I think the market's saying that the U.S. economy is in deep recession and will continue for perhaps longer than people expect.
What about the inflation issue? We've been hearing from economists here that it's okay to print money, it's okay to stimulate the economy with all these low interest rates, and yes, there will be inflationary consequences, but they're way down the line, maybe 2 years out. It seems like the dollar's drop is saying, nope, actually it could be sooner than you think.
I think that's absolutely right, and I'm certain that, as we know, printing money is a surefire way to stimulate inflation, and I suspect that the inflation figures coming out for next year will be a surprise to the markets and will be much higher than expected.
What's the situation with the pound and the yen right now?
Well, certainly, U.S. dollar, as you said, 13-year low against the yen. The pound is being hit very, very badly. A lot of it based on sentiment. So against the U.S. dollar, actually, the U.S. dollar is holding fairly well against the pound.
Well, you know, a lot of people view these numbers and, you know, they kind of glaze over and think, you know, what the heck does this have to do with me? But are you seeing out there another example of money on the sidelines trying to find a safe place to park in an environment where almost everything results in declining value?
Absolutely right. There's been a huge move towards Japanese yen and also Swiss franc, both perceived to be very safe haven currencies, and we've seen them strengthen dramatically, and it's been particularly marked over the last month or so.
Do you think the dollar is a trend or that this is a short-term bounce and that things will stabilize between now and the end of the year?
I don't. I think the volatility will continue to the end of the year, but I would suspect that things will stabilize out early in the first quarter of next year. I think there's too much uncertainty in the markets at the moment for any real stabilization.
Lots of uncertainty, lots of noise, but the signal seems to be centered in the currency markets for right now. James Hickman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
James Hickman is managing director of Caxton FX Foreign Exchange, and they specialize in trading currencies for businesses buying outside of the UK.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 18th. Femi Okeh is here with the headlines.
Hello there, and the time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. New unemployment numbers just out this hour. Last week, the number of people who applied for benefits dropped to 554,000. That's more than analysts expected. Russia says that it will cut natural gas supplies to the Ukraine beginning on January the 1st if the country fails to pay off a $2 billion gas debt. The warning is likely to upset other European countries. There was a series of supply shortages in 2006 during a price dispute between Russia and Ukraine. President-elect Barack Obama says he and Colorado Senator Ken Salazar, as Interior Secretary, will make sure that Native Americans have a voice in his administration.
Among the many responsibilities Ken will bear as our next Secretary of the Interior is helping ensure that we finally live up to the treaty obligations that are owed to the first Americans.
We're expecting more news to come from the President-elect Barack Obama this morning as he hosts another press conference where he's expected to announce securities industry regulator Mary Shapiro to head the SEC. The agency is facing growing criticism for its failure to protect investors in the wake of the Madoff scandal. The man who incited the Rwandan genocide in 1994 has been sentenced to life in prison. The International Criminal Court for Rwanda has convicted Taylor Nest Bagosora this morning. He's believed to have designed a plan to murder thousands of Rwandans. China says that it will send warships to join international efforts to fight piracy in the waters of Somalia. Yesterday, an attack on a Chinese ship was halted only when international forces intervened. More than 100 boats have been attacked in the Gulf of Aden so far this year. And that's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So for the British, it's ABBA, but what's your recession antidote?
Hi, my name is Bruce Cassidy. I live in Down East Maine, and because of the recession being here for a long time, I listen to Jimmy Buffett's Fruitcakes to get me up and running, and it works every time with no after effects.
Fruitcakes in the kitchen. Fruitcakes in the kitchen. Fruitcakes on the street.
Buffett, ABBA, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Let's get us all through this recession, eh?
We turn now to Zimbabwe. There, in the midst of a deadly cholera outbreak and renewed international calls for President Robert Mugabe to step down, Mugabe has announced he will form a unity government soon. Cholera has killed more than 1,000 people, according to the UN. U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe, James McGee, says the country is rapidly deteriorating into a failed state. He joins us now from Washington. Ambassador McGee, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Adora. Pleased to be here.
So how would you describe the specifics that led you to that conclusion?
Adora, the specifics are very simple. We are totally alarmed by the reports of the rise in cholera deaths and infections. As you mentioned, there are now over 1,000 reported deaths and over 18,000 reported cases of cholera in Zimbabwe and the neighboring countries. And this is a situation that does not need to happen. It did not need to happen. It's just a lack of willingness or ability of the government to deal with this situation.
Ambassador McGee, we're hoping that you can help us understand something. We've been following what's been happening in Zimbabwe for months now. All kinds of words have been used to describe Robert Mugabe. Delusional. Every day there are reports of people dying either from cholera now or from malnutrition or from clashes between opposition party members and Mugabe's ruling party. There's no food. Inflation is so bad that people are bartering now because the money is essentially worthless. How in the world does Mugabe hold on to power?
Oh, I think it's a combination of things, Adoria. Number one, Mugabe still controls the security forces, and he retains the loyalty of the head of those security forces. So he does have a large and at one time fairly professional security force, maybe the most professional in all of Africa. Now, it's lost a lot of its ability, but it's still there. They do provide that type of cover for the president. And the other thing that I think is extremely important, the real risk takers, those young men and young women who would be out in the streets throwing rocks at policemen, even with guns in their hands, those folks have left Zimbabwe. Things have become so bad that those folks at risk to their lives waded mm-hmm. across the Limpopo River into South Africa or crossed the border into Botswana and are now serving as waiters or cooks in those countries.
And so why hasn't the international community, the African community, or the U.S. been able to help mediate the political situation there following the elections this year?
We have tried our best, and we continue to work that issue. The real issue comes down to this, is that it's a issue that the Mugabe government refuses to act in good faith on the global political agreement of September 15th. ZANU-PF and the MDC, this agreement is not going to be viable as long as Robert Mugabe fails to comply with the provisions of this agreement. And so far, he has refused to do so.
I mean, clearly there's a crisis at the moment. We were talking about the cholera outbreak, and that's directly tied to the inability for the government to provide clean water to the population. What are aid agencies doing at this point to deal with that?
Well, I think that I'm very, very proud of what the United States is doing with this, as well as our colleagues in the rest of the international community. Just earlier this week, Deputy Secretary Henrietta Fore announced an additional $6.2 million for anti-cholera efforts coming from the United States. We've had bump-ups in assistance coming from Australia, from the European Union, and from other actors in Zimbabwe. And this is exactly what we want to see. We have a problem here. We need to continue to see international assistance coming into Zimbabwe because, as you mentioned, clearly the government of Zimbabwe has no ability or willingness to deal with this issue.
And let's take a step back and think about the region for a moment. In South Africa, they're having their own political difficulties as the African National Congress is essentially split and they're dealing with upcoming elections and some other issues there. Has that had a profound impact on the ability of countries in the southern region to put pressure on Zimbabwe and Mugabe?
I don't think that we can say that that is the cause there. I think it's important to note that Robert Mugabe is still viewed as a liberation struggle hero by many people and many countries and all across Africa. The reality now that is starting to seep out, though, that that Mugabe has lost this mantle. He's lost everything that he worked so hard for earlier in his life because of nothing more than greed. He and his cronies are enriching themselves while the people of Zimbabwe suffered through horrible hardships.
And so what do you think, is there anyone, any leader who can negotiate with him? Having lived in Zimbabwe like you have and representing the United States, you know him. What do you think it is going to take in order for him to change direction?
I think it's going to take a concerted effort by SADC, by the African Union, and maybe even by the United Nations to make extremely clear to Robert Mugabe and his cronies that enough is enough, that they have to leave office and allow a representative government, a government that reflects the will of the people of Zimbabwe as expressed in the March elections, to move in and take care of the issues in this country. It's plain for everyone to see now that this government is not doing that.
And what is it going to take for that pressure to come from those African leaders?
Well, I think that's something that we're starting to see. I think that the tide is now starting to turn. We've seen calls from Botswana, from Kenya, from Lesotho, and other countries all calling upon Mugabe to leave. The Mugabe regime must leave. And we call on other African nations to do the same.
But what's the consequence if he doesn't?
That remains to be seen. Zimbabwe is a signatory to all the conventions of SADC and human rights, protection of its own citizens. Those are all things in the SADC conventions that Zimbabwe is breaking right now. And, it's going to be SADC, ECOWAS, the EAC, the African Union. All of those bodies together have to step forward and say enough is enough.
And do you see that happening in 2009?
I certainly do hope so, Adora.
Thanks for being with us, Ambassador. Ambassador James McGee, he is the U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe, and he joined us from Washington, D.C.
Clearly a country on the edge, and our listeners certainly listen closely.
Yes, hi there. This is Charlie Etzer. In these times, to cheer myself up, I like to listen to the song Eve of Destruction, because it strikes me that that song was written over 40 years ago, and if we were on the Eve of Destruction 40 years ago, I guess it wasn't quite so bad as we thought.
You don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Zimbabwe, the cities, or the current recession? Our listeners have suggestions on what they listen to get them out of the recessionary woes. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Here is your takeaway.
So many lies are told about the British. We don't have sex. We've got bad teeth. But ultimately,
and your point would be what, Paddy?
These are lies.
It's Paddy O'Connell, host of Broadcasting House on BBC Radio, talking about the Brits turning to ABBA in these times. Tell us your take. We're always on. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
When an Illinois governor is in trouble, it's time to engage the emergency governor defense system.
We're talking about a spike mic and a wall. You're talking about other phone conversations being monitored. The thousands and thousands of conversations might tell something entirely different.
Ed Jensen is Governor Rod Blagojevich's defense attorney, and he's facing down the Illinois legislature, the attorney general, even, you might say, the U.S. Senate. Jensen talks, Blagojevich walks. Your witness, counselor, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Uh-oh, I'm sorry, John. I was busy putting emergency governor defense system into
yes,
Wikipedia.
The emergency governor defense system. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning. It's December 18th. Today, the latest on Blackwater. The State Department is recommending the security company get a pink slip. A report on a Rwandan who's been sentenced to life for his role in the genocide. And a look at the role bonuses have played and do play on Wall Street. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
There's no place like home. That's something Chrysler and GM employees may be reminded of more than they'd like this holiday season. Chrysler's closing all 30 of its manufacturing plants until January 19th, at least. Company spokesman Ed Garston says there just aren't enough sales to stay open.
People don't have access to credit, and if they don't have access to credit, it just makes it very difficult for them to make the decision to purchase or lease a new vehicle.
Ford is also planning to shut down 10 plants for an extra week, and Chrysler has restarted merger discussions with GM, according to the Wall Street Journal.
Could the alleged Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme be a family affair? The SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, is checking it out. Madoff's niece is married to a former SEC lawyer who examined Madoff's firm twice in the past decade. Meanwhile, Attorney General Michael Mukasey is recusing himself from the SEC investigation. His son is representing a top financial officer at Madoff's investment firm.
Barack Obama is continuing to select his team. His next pick is Mary Shapiro, head of the SEC. She'll be the first woman to fill the post. Maybe it feels a little bit like gym class in middle school. You know, he's picking people or standing in a line to be a part of his team.
It's a very long line.
It's a very long line. He's also choosing a kid. Everyone's got their hand up. Pick me.
Right.
He's also choosing a kid from the other side of the tracks today. A Republican, Illinois Congressman Ray LaHood, will be the second Republican to join Team Obama.
The Illinois Supreme Court has refused to hear a challenge to remove Governor Blagojevich from office. Attorney General Lisa Madigan had argued the governor's legal problems were keeping him from doing his job. Blagojevich says he wants to have the opportunity to explain himself.
I can't wait to begin to tell my side of the story and to address you guys and, most importantly, the people of Illinois. That's who I'm dying to talk to.
We can't wait either. He's been charged, of course, with trying to sell Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat. New unemployment numbers just out this hour. Last week, the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits dropped to 544,000, more than analysts expected. But still high. Yeah, 54,000, excuse me. The total is 554,000.
Right.
That's more than analysts expected. The drop, in any case, the number of overall claims is still historically high. What musical, movie, or song do you listen to when you need a little shot of sunshine on these dark recessionary days?
Don't forget Star Wars.
The Empire will save us. Call 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with a story that's working its way through the corridors of Washington. The State Department may be ready to deliver a pretty important verdict on the use of private contractors in Iraq. The department announced yesterday it may recommend that the U.S. drop Blackwater, the main private security contractor for American diplomats in Iraq. Blackwater is a subcontractor that does security work in Iraq and other places around the world and actually supplements the U.S. military in that country. And join us for some answers about the future of Blackwater and contractors like it that were very much a part of Donald Rumsfeld's policy in Iraq and Afghanistan is Washington Post foreign correspondent Steve Fainaru. He has a new book called Big Boy Rules, which is a profile of America's mercenaries fighting in Iraq. For research on that book, he actually went undercover and embedded in Blackwater. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
In both style and in kind of policy implications, and last year, of course, we all know that Blackwater was involved in an operation that ended up killing 17 Iraqi civilians and resulting in five manslaughter charges. So what's the likely future of Blackwater?
Well, I think what's clear is that the future is changing rapidly for Blackwater. I think this report really sort of states the obvious that, Blackwater's days in Iraq may soon be numbered. But I think what's interesting is that what we're seeing just in the last few weeks is that the sort of culture of impunity that grew up around Blackwater and that in many ways Blackwater symbolized for not only that company, but for tens of thousands of private security contractors, may well be coming to an end. As I think you mentioned, five Blackwater contractors were indicted recently for their role in the massacre of some 17 people in a Baghdad traffic circle in 2007. And at the same time, the immunity that was granted by the United States government for all security contractors in Iraq in 2004 was also lifted as part of the new status of forces agreement between the United States and Iraq. But I think what's obvious, for a second,
Steve, do you think that Blackwater complicated those negotiations on the status of forces agreement because immunity for subcontractors was a part of the issue there?
Yeah, I don't think it was just Blackwater. I think it was all security contractors. Blackwater had killed before this massacre. They had been involved in a series of really questionable shooting incidents, in which the State Department had effectively done nothing to investigate or take action on. It wasn't just Blackwater. It was a number of private security companies that were involved in shootings, and no action was taken. And I think for the Iraqi government, this became a real issue, that could you have civilians, armed civilians operating in the country with really no law overseeing them. And I think I wouldn't say it complicated the situation. I think it became a matter of Iraq as the situation changes in that country, beginning to assert its sovereignty.
Right. Steve, before we go, are troops losing the expectation that they can leave a career in the military as a covert ops or as an infantry and go to one of these subcontractors as a result of all of this criticism?
No, I don't think that's going to change. I don't think the work is suddenly – there's still going to be a lot of security work to be done in Iraq, and the companies go where the money is. And what I think is changing is will these people, if you go into a career in this, are you going to be completely above the law?
Right.
I still think there are going to be thousands of people who are being willing to do the work.
All right, Steve Fenneru, Washington Post foreign correspondent, author of Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq, talking about the changing role for Blackwater and certainly the significantly evolving role of subcontractors in Iraq. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
And that's exactly right, John. It's going to be interesting to see how that evolves because the people, the boots on the ground, are actually needed. In Detroit, bad news. Chrysler clearly is in trouble. The automaker announced late yesterday it will close all of their manufacturing plants, all of its manufacturing plants, for at least 1 month beginning Friday. Micheline Maynard is a business correspondent for the New York Times who covers the auto industry, and we welcome her back to The Takeaway. Good morning, Micheline.
Good morning.
So is this the beginning of the end, Mickey?
I'm not sure that's quite the case, but you have to understand that there are a lot of important people in Washington who are working on a possible bailout for the car companies. And one of the things we hadn't seen up until now is any sign that they were in an emergency situation, that they actually were possibly going to run out of cash by the end of the month. So this sends a pretty clear signal. If a company's in trouble, there's nothing that says it like shutting down 30 plants for an extra couple weeks all at once.
So how does this work exactly? How many employees does this affect? And essentially, does that mean no work at all by Chrysler?
Essentially, yes. There's 46,000 manufacturing employees in North America. This also affects about 8,000 workers up in Canada. They were given notice that they already knew that they would be away during Christmas season, that most of the plants were going to shut down for a couple of weeks over the holidays. But they've basically been told, don't expect to come back to your jobs any sooner then January 19th. And, of course, the words any sooner caused all kinds of ears to prick up in Detroit yesterday, because that's sort of hinting that it no sooner than that and possibly a lot later.
Does this mean that General Motors or does this mean that, any of these companies that are shutting down, and Ford announced a 10-day furlough, I guess, or an additional or a furlough of a week for 10 of its plants, is this an indication that either Ford or Chrysler are not going to pay suppliers this month or maybe early in January next month?
No, I think that's too big of a conclusion to leap to. I think what this is really being caused by is the fact that car sales have just about dried up. I believe Chrysler sales were down something like 47% in November. And one of the things that Chrysler dealers are complaining about is that they have people who would like to buy cars, but they can't get financing. And in fact, Chrysler actually asked its dealers to stop tapping a fund that's there for emergency borrowing. They can come to this fund if they can't get lending from their area banks. And they basically told them, you're pulling too much money out of it, and please only tap it for emergencies. And I've never heard of anything like that in the years that I've been covering the car companies.
And let's talk about that. So essentially, the dealers are borrowing money from Chrysler, but then are they not using that money to lend to people who want to buy cars?
No. They're borrowing money from Chrysler because they can't borrow from their local banks or from their own sources of financing.
But that's still money, then, that's going into the system every day.
It's supposed to be going into the system, but it's also money that Chrysler doesn't really want them to tap. It's kind of an emergency backup. And what it would prefer to do is that the dealers get their allowances for keeping cars on the showroom floor from just other sources of financing, from the banks in their local community or the banks with which they have lines of credit. You know, that's there to basically keep the lights on. And what they're saying is just borrow from that when you absolutely need it. Well, I think a lot of dealers are saying we absolutely need it.
And we're talking about $60 million a day, at least according to one report I saw.
Right. Well, you have to remember that Chrysler has, I think it's about 3,600 dealers across the country. So for every dealer to borrow against it, you know, if you do the math, it's something that they're tapping, and it's something that Chrysler just doesn't want them to use as much as they have.
So in Detroit, what's the great hope of what might happen in Capitol Hill before the end of the year?
Well, Capitol Hill's done. Congress has said that
the White House.
Yeah, they are not going to help. So the White House and the Treasury are now meeting on this. And I think the hope was that they'd already have a check by now. I think there was great expectation that Congress would stop working, which they did on Thursday, and that the car makers could expect the money in the mail already. And instead, what the White House is saying is that, you know, we'll get you your check, but we're going to do this in an orderly fashion. It's raising the expectation that more than just a simple, you know, get-by check is coming out of this whole situation.
Mickey, is there any chance that, or is there a target of Chrysler reducing its inventories while these plants are down, that dealers would sell cars off the lot and that they would want to hit some sort of target? Any expectation of that?
Well, that's certainly the hope. But one of the fears is that Chrysler has gone back to practice of a couple summers ago, which is called the order bank, where they've been building cars and putting them off to the side without any specific dealer orders. Well, that's what got Chrysler in trouble the summer before it needed a federal bailout in 1979, and it got Chrysler in trouble a couple summers ago when over 100,000 cars were built. So I think what Chrysler's trying to do is not have that happen again, because it'll just be a bigger mess after the first of the year.
Micheline Maynard, thanks so much. Micheline, Mickey, as we'd like to call her here, is a Michigan-based business correspondent for the New York Times. Thanks for being with us. Tough times there in Detroit.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Economists, of course, are debating endlessly on how the world is going to pull out of its global recession. The British are apparently not taking their cue and deciding spiritually to pull out of the recession by listening to ABBA music. Mamma Mia is the biggest grossing movie in the UK of all time. There are also people who could just make up their own songs.
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota, and I'm a songwriter who happens to love news coverage. So when I get bored, I write musical scores for news stories, and I think the Somali pirate stories sound like an ill-conceived Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. And my main anthem for that imaginary production goes like this. Bum, 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 we're pirates, Somali pirates. We threaten some violence to get what we want.
Troy, are you a contributor to our show, or is that the most desperate cry for help I've ever heard? Cheer us up with happy-making, recession-banishing movie musicals, even your own. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
This week, oh, we do. We appreciate every contribution that Troy makes. So my money's on he's a contributor and as opposed to someone who needs help. Anyhow,
too much. We'll have to pay him. We don't
want to the market. On to market news and stories. This week, Goldman Sachs, a longtime top performer, reported a quarterly loss of more than $2 billion. Its first quarterly loss since going public 9 years ago. Profits are gone for most and many companies on Wall Street, but bonuses from earlier this year and the past decade have been very real, with some individuals taking home hundreds of millions of dollars. The lavish bonuses, some argue, may have provided incentives that led directly to the meltdown. Louise Story is covering the story for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning and welcome, Louise.
Hi there.
So describe to us this culture of bonuses. People get basic salaries on Wall Street, but really the bonuses is where the money has always been.
That's right. Wall Street pay has been growing and growing in the past couple decades, and it grew in the bonuses. And it got to the point where salaries were a tiny portion of a worker's pay, and it was the bonus that they were living on from year to year.
Like, you have this example of Dow Kim in 2006. He was at Merrill Lynch. His salary was $350,000, but his total compensation was 100 times that, $35 million?
That's right. That's a striking example.
Louise?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. That's a striking example, but it really is representative of the culture here. Why did it provide incentives in ways that may have not necessarily been good for the company or for the American economy?
Many of the assets that the Wall Street firms were trading, particularly the structured finance assets like mortgage bonds, are hard to value, and it's unclear what they're really worth. And so at the end of the year, when traders and executives were marking down what they owned, they had incentives to be overly optimistic because their pay was linked to those hazy valuations.
And it was the pay of everyone from the lowest rung of the company straight up to the CEOs, right?
That's right. Even an analyst who might be 27 years old contributed to the valuations that went all the way up to the top and helped add up to the bonus pool that came to their division.
And why did you choose to focus on 2006 in your report today, which is in the New York Times?
In 2006, across the entire street, bonuses were the highest they'd ever been, and it was the last year before banks started taking write-downs. It's the year that the most toxic mortgage bonds were issued that have caused the most write-downs. So when we look at the pain that's come, it's come out of the investments that were made in 2006 when people were paid big bonuses for making those investments.
You know, Louise, I can hear a frequent guest on our program. You may have even talked to him, Peter Morici, who's an economist down at University of Maryland. He's always screaming about how the compensation is basically driving these companies into the ground. I don't know if that's so much really the issue here, but it certainly pays to have been at the front of the parade. Stan O'Neill from Merrill Lynch got an enormous chunk of money, even though he was one of the very first casualties as the crisis began to emerge.
That's That's right. This is an issue that all corners of finance should do more thinking on. Even at hedge funds, if a trader makes a lot of money, is paid a lot of money on a valuation that's not true in a few years, he or she doesn't suffer. So it's really investors who might be able to push financial institutions to tie compensation over much longer periods and put in provisions to allow aggressive clawbacks if those valuations were not right.
And does that happen anywhere on the market now?
UBS and Morgan Stanley just introduced policies that will be used in the future, but there were no policies at any large place in recent years that would have applied to 2006, except a lot of banks have provisions for outright fraud. You know, if someone was, you know, knowingly making accounting statements that were wrong, this is hazier. Valuation is hazier than outright fraud.
But I think for most of us who don't live in a world where your bonuses are everything, it's just hard to understand how you can benefit from something that doesn't exist.
Well, you know, as we look at so much of what's happening in the financial world, these complicated structured bonds and instruments are tied to valuations that we won't know about for a long time. And so that's another thing I think we'll see on Wall Street is a lot more simplification of the investment structure so that investors know more what they're getting now.
Louise Story, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Louise Story is from the New York Times, and she's got a story today about the bonus incentives in Wall Street, on Wall Street. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got the latest headlines for us.
Good morning. Time just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. The weekly jobless claims came out this morning. They dropped to 554,000, but that still keeps them near a 26-year high. Detroit's Big Three are scaling back even more for the holidays. Ed Garston from Chrysler says that the company is cutting production drastically.
After the last shift this Friday, manufacturing operations will be idled. And employees at those plants won't return to work any sooner than Monday, January 19th.
And Chrysler is closing all 30 of its North American manufacturing plants. And GM is halting construction of a plant involved in producing the Volt. And Ford also says it will shut down 10 plants for an extra week in January. A State Department advisory panel is recommending that Blackwater Worldwide be dropped as the main private security contractor for American diplomats in Iraq. A decision on the panel's recommendation will be left to the Obama administration. Attorney General Michael Mukasey is recusing himself from the investigation into Bernie Madoff's alleged $50 billion investment fraud. The AG's son is representing a top financial officer at Madoff's investment firm. And the Screen Actors Guild sends out strike authorization ballots early next month, but some big-name celebs are saying not now and not during a recession. Among the A-listers who signed a letter opposing a strike, George Clooney, Glenn Close and Tom Hanks. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
So, as we've been asking you all morning, thank goodness there's music in these times.
This is Josh Gutas, and when I cheer myself up, the iPod in my head plays Fred Astaire singing Slap That Bass.
Slap that bass, slap it till it's dizzy, slap that bass, keep the rhythm busy, zoom, 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 misery, you got to go.
What suggestions do you have? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
That's
Thank
a fun one.
For
That's
music.
A fun
yes.
song. Definitely. I could see why that would cheer you
yes,
up.
Indeed. Well, you know, there's also, you know, there's all kinds of music in times like these. And, you know, we wanted to remind all of you tonight that one of classical music's most revered figures, gives his final performance concert in the Vienna Golden Auditorium. That's tonight. And here to talk about the life and legacy of pianist Alfred Brendel is WNYC music host Terrence McKnight. Terrence, you know, this is a legendary character, an individual whose relationship to the piano and piano music is both sort of beautiful and also intellectually deep.
Alfred Brendel, he's the last, perhaps, John, of a generation of these great titans. You know, one of these pianists who has recorded. You know, we talk about what classical music is, but right. Brendel really played that music that's classical. You know, that Viennese school, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert. He really championed Haydn. He really championed that great literature of that great body of piano music from that period.
And recording entire bodies of music is really one of his signatures.
Right. He's one of those guys. I mean, I think Vladimir Ashkenazy also. They recorded, you know, all this, you know, all of the Beethoven concertos. For example, I think all of the music of Beethoven, all of the piano music of right. Beethoven was played by this and recorded by this man. And tonight's his farewell.
Well, let's pretend that we're there. I'm sitting in the seats here in Vienna. And here's Alfred. A sense of touch, a sense of phrasing, and a sort of a one-on-one relationship with the piano. There's nobody like him.
And also, what makes Brendel so special is that by recording these whole, you know, bodies of music, all of Mozart's concertos, all of Beethoven's piano music.
This is Mozart really, here, right?
This is Mozart right yeah. here. This is what he's going to play tonight. This is his farewell. Mozart wrote this when he was 21, his piano concerto number 9. But you're able to see how these pianists, how these composers progress through their career, through their writing, in Brendel's music. I mean, you can trace Beethoven's 3 major periods and hear how he grew as a composer when you listen to Alfred Brendel, because he studied this music. He wasn't one of those guys who, one of those pianists who had a prodigious talent, mm-hmm. you know, who was playing with orchestras when he was 9 or 10 years
right.
old. He had his big debut when he was 17 years old. So he really had to work hard. He had to practice a lot. He had to study hard.
And he's self-directed. I mean, it wasn't like music was on in his house. He says that, you know, he wasn't raised in a musical background.
That's
like,
right.
You know, Mozart, who was sort of dragged around Europe playing the violin by his dad.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear some Brendel Beethoven.
I brought you this, John, because this comes from Beethoven's farewell sonata. One of his patrons was leaving town, and it was also his friend, his student, and he was leaving town, so Beethoven wrote this sonata for him, and this movement actually is called The Return. So, you know, you think about some pianists who perhaps retire, like Vladimir Horowitz retired twice, I think.
Right.
So I think a lot of people would like to see Alfred Brendel return. I mean, he said he wanted to quit while he was still in good shape. I mean, he has a lot of things that he wants to do. He writes essays, he's written books, he writes poetry, he reads poetry, he likes
a Renaissance
visual
man.
A real Renaissance man.
Well, let's listen. You mentioned Horowitz retiring twice, right? He's sort of the Mike Tyson of pianists. Do you think Brendel will come back?
Or maybe the Evander Holyfield.
There you go. But, you know, he's a scholar as much as a performer. I mean, musicologists, you know, guys who have radio shows like yours are really going to miss Brendel.
Well, you know, someone said that Brendel was going to leave a hole when he retired, and he said, well, at least I'll leave something.
He's a very soft-spoken guy. I think of him a little bit like Glenn Gould, you know, not as eccentric as Glenn Gould, but certainly someone with this inner world in his relationship to music.
Yeah, perhaps not as eccentric on stage.
Yeah.
I mean, on stage, you know, he was pretty straightforward. There were, you know, no, you know, no odd socks or no small piano bench or no, you know, extra things happening. He just gave you the music. But off stage, you know, there were some anecdotes about some things that he'd do, like be in a restaurant and walk out because he didn't like the background music. So
very particular about his music.
That's right.
You got a ticket for tonight? It's a little late to get there.
Yeah, it's a little late to get there.
Yeah. Terrence McKnight, as always, on All Things Musical. Thanks for joining us. Terrence McKnight is the WNYC's host of Evening Music right here on this radio station. Thanks, Terrence.
Thanks, you guys.
From Brendel and Beethoven to Femi Oke with the headlines.
Thank you very much. It's coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. New weekly unemployment numbers out this morning. The number of people who applied for benefits dropped to 554,000, and that's still more than analysts expected. And I'm going to just take a minute to get you really caught up on the latest in the case of Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. On the state level, the Illinois Supreme Court yesterday refused to hear a challenge from the state's AG about whether Blagojevich is fit to hold office. And Blagojevich's lawyer, Ed Jensen, says that his client will not use his constitutional powers to appoint anybody to fill President-elect Barack Obama's Senate seat. Jensen is sticking to his story that the federal charges against his client are just jabbering and not actual wrongdoing.
It seems to me that maybe, maybe, someone ought to consider that we get real evidence. And that's what somebody said that somebody said that somebody said.
Now, Blagojevich also talked to the reporters yesterday.
I can't wait to begin to tell my side of the story and to address you guys and, most importantly, the people of Illinois. That's who I'm dying to talk to.
The governor is expected to hold a news conference tomorrow. And finally, President-elect Obama spent some time yesterday trying to deflect press speculation that he's waiting until next week, that's a big holiday week, to release an internal staff report about contact his staff may have had with Blagojevich about his vacated Senate seat.
We are going to get this blow by blow by blow.
Okay.
Well, that's great.
Rounded up a few blows for you there.
Thank you.
All right.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. The Rwandan genocide killed more than 500,000 people. Today, a UN court convicted the man prosecutors say was one of the organizers of the killings and sentenced him to life. We spoke earlier to Peter Gresta, the BBC's East Africa correspondent. He's covering the story from Nairobi.
Good morning.
So tell us about the man who was sentenced.
Well, the man is Teonesta Bagasora, a 67-year-old man who was at the time one of the very senior officials in the defense ministry. Now, the tribunal found him guilty of organizing the genocide as far back as 1990, that's 3 or 4 years before the genocide actually took place. And he apparently worked with a number of senior military officers, two of which were convicted alongside him, to draw up a document that the president had commissioned that was supposed to look at the people that they regarded as the enemies of the state, the enemies of Rwanda. And they defined the enemies as the Tutsi population, the minority Tutsis. And over the subsequent years, they organized the Interahamwe, which were the notorious militias, the Hutu militias, that eventually became the core of the killing machine that led to those 500,000 deaths or more that you've just spoken of. And they armed them, they trained them, they brought in the weapons, and they also gave the orders for the genocide to begin when the moment finally came.
And Peter, why has it taken so long? You're talking about crimes that took place 14 years ago.
That's right. It is an extraordinarily long time. It's taken them years and years to get to this stage. In fact, Mr. Bagasora's trial itself took 5 years. It began in 2002 and ended in the middle of last year, and it's taken them a year and a half to get to this verdict. And I think that's a pretty solid indication of just how complicated the evidence has been, how complicated the trial process has been. But I have to say the whole tribunal has also been pretty widely criticized for the way that it's conducted the trials, for the time that it's taken. But nonetheless, they have reached a verdict, and probably the most significant verdict in the tribunal's history, because this is the one man that has been accused of being the mastermind of that incredible atrocity.
Do you think it's significant in the bigger scheme of things, given what's happening right now in Rwanda and the conflict with the Congo?
Absolutely, I think it is. In fact, it's already been welcomed by a number of human rights groups, including Human Rights Watch, as sending a very clear signal to people around the world, to leaders around the world, that that justice will eventually catch up with them. There's been a lot of debate about whether or not these kinds of trials are healthy for a country still trying to recover from the kinds of ethnic divisions that we saw in Rwanda and we're now seeing unfold in the eastern Congo. But I think there's also a feeling that you have to go through with these kinds of processes. You have to see justice has to be done, because the wounds will continue to fester if they're not, if these crimes aren't uncovered and if the perpetrators aren't eventually brought to book. And I think that's one of the reasons why the human rights campaigners are hailing this particular decision.
Peter Gresta, BBC East Africa correspondent, he spoke to us from Nairobi, a very convoluted situation, and particularly the same tensions now in Congo.
Well, the danger, I think, is that people will think that the Bagasora conviction suggests that there was only one person responsible for the genocide, when in fact broad participation by all levels of society.
Systematic.
Particularly the media, even. And none of those people are even counted in these bringing to justice crusades.
Well, it's a systematic campaign from every aspect, the business community, the media community, the government. It was all one big massive campaign.
What will happen to them?
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 18th. Femi Oke is here with the latest headlines.
And the time is 30 minutes to the top of the hour. President-elect Barack Obama continues to make appointments. Some new names out this hour: Georgetown University law professor Dan Tarullo to fill an open seat on the Federal Reserve Board. That's according to some Democratic officials. And the announcement is expected at a news conference in Chicago later this morning. Former Treasury official Gary Gensler is also expected to join Team Obama. He'll be the next head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Conservative leader Paul Weyrich died this morning, age 66. He helped found the Heritage Foundation, that's a think tank based in Washington, and he's considered to have been a major influence on the conservative movement in Washington back in the 70s and 80s.
An enormously influential person. He brought it in Congress originally.
And next story, I'm just going to dip back into some old-style newscasting, courtesy of the NFL website.
Sengyumba is guilty of genocide, crimes against humanity.
I bet that's not from the NFL.
It wasn't. I'm sorry about that. No, I was going to bring you a little bit of slinging Sammy Bowe. He died yesterday at the age of 94, and he's been hampered by numerous health issues in the recent years. And he played for the Washington Redskins from 1937 to 1952. Let's dip into those archives one more time.
Slingin' Sammy Baugh, though 36 years old and with 15 seasons of pro competition behind him, gives no signs of nearing the end of his amazing career.
It's amazing. He lived to 94.
94.
NFL players today don't live to 94.
And it was that forward pass he brought into frequent play, which is now part of modern football. And, okay, I've got one more little Christmas gift for you. If you like your perfume on the meaty side, check out Burger King. They are selling a scent along with the hamburgers and the milkshakes. So it might
be a scent?
Yes.
Like you can wear, like a hamburger?
Man perfume. Meaty. Hunky.
Oh,
relish.
Okay, have a good weekend there, FM.
Thank you. Coming up.
So the English are using ABBA to pull themselves out of their economic depression. Is there a movie, a musical, or a song you listen to when you need a shot of sunshine?
This is Bob from the East Village. As an adjunct professor recently laid off,
I've been listening to Trouble Every Day by the Mothers of Invention from the album Freak Out.
About the whiskey passing around, seen the smoke and fire and the market burning down. Watch
Love Zappa, 877-8 My Take.
One of the keys of the kingdom of healthcare to the kingdom of healthcare is something called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's being rewritten, which means patients and insurance companies and pharmaceuticals all have a vested interest in what goes out and what goes in. Joining us is New York Times science reporter Benedict Carey. He's been covering what the folks at the DSM are up to. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
So it is a very complicated and hard-fought battle for which diseases make it in and which are taken out. Where does it stand today? What are some of the issues at stake?
Well, there's a whole bunch of them. It's a huge book. It's one of the big, juicy books of medicine, probably about 900 to 1,000 pages long. It is like an encyclopedia. And it's divided up into sections, categories of disorders that run from like substance abuse all the way up to personality disorders. And so there are little battles that occur in trying to include or maybe exclude certain things. So I'll give a few examples. Something called binge eating disorder is something that a lot of people want to include. However, a somewhat normal behavior, a lot of people do that. So there's some real debate about whether it belongs in there as a disorder.
Because essentially, if a disease makes it into the book, it's more likely to be covered by insurance companies. It's more likely that the drug companies will spend time looking for some kind of cure or something to help that person who's suffering from that disease. And if it's not in there, then it may not be covered.
That's right. The diseases have codes, diagnostic codes, which are used to get insurance coverage. And so once something's in there, not only can you get coverage, or you should be able to get coverage, but it also drives research and, as you say, drug development. So it really creates a kind of institution out of a disorder or a description that wasn't one before.
Who decides?
Well, the DSM is published by the American Psychiatric Association. They choose panels of experts, mostly psychiatrists, some other kinds of experts, who focus on specific parts. So there's one group looking at substance abuse, another group looking at mood disorders, another at personality disorders. Those groups then take they meet, they look at the evidence, they make recommendations to an overall task force. And that group, it's a group of, I think, about 28 people, some big shots in psychiatry, sit around, look at this stuff, and decide, okay, is adult ADD really a full-on disorder?
Oh, yeah, it is.
That kind of stuff.
Oh, definitely.
Well, what's controversial this go-around? Because it's not a manual that is updated that often, only every 7 or 10 years?
That's right. It takes some time to develop evidence in these areas, and I think that's part of the reason why they wait. Almost everything's controversial that they do for the reasons we just explained, that it matters so much in terms of reimbursement and research. So one of the things that almost certainly be controversial is something called gender identity disorder, which is described in the DSM manual, the current one, as a dissatisfaction, deep dissatisfaction with your born biological gender. This is a very active group split about what the DSM should say about this. Some want it out altogether. They want nothing to do with psychiatrists and feel it should not be labeled a mental disorder. Others argue that, well, if it is a diagnosis, it's at least one way to get treatments covered. And so there's some real controversy and debate about that in the transgender community. But that's one for sure that will be controversial.
So does it boil down to what the medical research says, or does it boil down to whoever is the most powerful politically when the decision is being made?
Well, it's tricky to answer that. The psychiatrist certainly would say the scientific research, but this is a field that, of course, has no blood tests for medical disorder, for disorders. So there's a lot that is in the interpretation. So you look at sort of what's been done the last 7 to 10 years, and you sort of argue about it and make a decision that way. And yes, I think that certainly factions can form. People have their biases. The whole debate about homosexuality in the 1970s, there were psychiatrists who believed that that should be included as a mental disorder. There were others who disagreed. And so a lot of this sort of back and forth goes on in these meetings.
How much of the DSM relates to standard of care issues, the treatments, as opposed to actually including something as a disease or a specific disorder?
Zero on treatments.
Really?
Nothing. Yeah.
So the doctors can do anything as far as treatment is concerned. Really, all we're talking about is a description of the disease, symptoms that characterize it, and its classification and code.
Exactly. That's all we're talking about. And that's a difficult thing to do, again, because this is not cardiology. There are no good, hard biological markers to say you have, this or that, or you have, an overactive prostate or whatever it is. This is a matter of sort of organizing these behavioral descriptions into groupings that seem to sort of fit the person and a description.
Can you quickly tell us some of the disorders or diseases that are going to be taken out of DSM this go-round?
Let me think. I think there's only one. Well, there's a couple things that might happen. One is, this is all handicapping, by the way. The APA, the American Psychiatric Association, is trying to contain discussion about this a little bit. No one knows what's going to happen. But, for example, Asperger's syndrome is a developmental disorder characterized by sort of social oddity and difficulty. Very difficult to distinguish that from what they call high-functioning autism. So that's one conversation that will happen. Asperger's may be folded into high-functioning autism. It would be a huge deal because Asperger's is its own subculture, and there's a sort of self-identity that goes into that and is considered by many to be distinct. It's just very hard to distinguish the diagnosis.
Benedict Carey, thanks very much. Benedict is a science writer with our partner, The New York Times, and his piece on the DSM and the changes in the works appears in today's paper.
I think I'm like a lot of people. I like to self-medicate with music.
Hi, I'm Carla Bond. I listen to Sam Cooke singing A Change Is Gonna Come over and over and over again.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
That's actually funny because I was singing that song yesterday.
We
funny
love
that
it.
She brings that up.
When you sing to us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Here's some cheering up for Chrysler executives.
If a company's in trouble, there's nothing that says it like shutting down 30 plants for an extra couple weeks.
Vacation, furlough, or sign of a recession. It's your takeaway with Mickey Maynard, Michigan-based business correspondent for The New York Times. Chrysler announced it's closing its manufacturing plants for a month, but you know that. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway, and that's Sam Cooke.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.